Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Security Conversations podcast. My guest this week is Chris Necker, a partner at Two Bear Capital, a venture capital firm investing in cybersecurity companies. Chris has over 17 years of leadership experience, done a lot of important security research work at some pretty prominent companies, and we'll get into it in a little bit. But Chris, let's start at Two Bear Capital. What does a partner at Two Bear Capital do?
Well, I'm still kind of figuring that out myself. I've only been in the venture world for about a year. Going into venture, I had a pretty negative view of venture capital in general. I've seen a lot of negative happen in our industry because of venture dollars being injected into companies where they probably didn't belong. But was kind of convinced coming into this role that we have a very unique tack. And really what we're primarily focused on is bringing capitalization and the ability to actually build companies to founders who probably wouldn't otherwise be enabled in that way. So we like to focus on founders with very, very strong sort of technical backgrounds, and really enable them through capital injection and through assistance in company building to build sort of world-class companies.
You said you had a negative view of VC heading into it. Why go this route? And what removed that negativity for you?
Well, so I'm not sure how many of you remember the sort of Neohapsis story, but I started my career, coming out of college at Neohapsis, based out of Chicago, and really that team just was one of the most phenomenal security research teams I've ever had the opportunity to work on. John McDonald and Justin Chu and Rainforest Puppy and just all of these amazing minds in one place at one time.
And this is the early 2000s?
This is early 2000s. I believe I started in 2004, early 2004. So, I came on originally as an intern, and then was sort of promoted over time, largely because other people were leaving. But that sort of security research team and that vibe that we had, sort of that pirate attitude of we can do anything and we can break into anything in the world, was sort of ruined when Neo was forced to take venture backing. I don't really blame the funds that sort of invested in us, and it was certainly necessary for the company, but the story as it played out just gave me a very, very negative view of the venture world in general, and ended up definitely making the decision to, in the startups that I founded later, I bootstrapped everything. I was never very interested in taking venture funding because of that negative experience.
And the negative experience comes from what? Just unreasonable demands, like forcing the company into more strategically pushing the company into places it didn't belong. Like, what are some of those things?
There was a lot of push to get into sort of general risk and compliance. A lot of emphasis on the business side, where we had been very focused on sort of the technical offensive research side.
How do you bridge those two worlds, though? Because at some point, right, somebody's got to make money from this. If investors are investing their money, they need to see a return on the back end of things. The purity of the research is the purity of the research, and sometimes they don't quite mix, right?
Yeah.
How do you ensure there's a mix? And what are you bringing from those experiences to Two Bear Capital today to make sure that isn't a concern of your companies?
Yeah, I don't know that I have a great answer to that. My hope, my sincere hope, is that the right way to bridge that gap is through investment like ours. I really hope to bridge that gap by bringing both sides together. So by understanding, by sort of engaging with the CISOs of the world and having worn that hat now and understanding those concerns, and also just business concerns in general, investor concerns, LP concerns, the need to actually turn a business into a profit generation center.
Right, right.
And then also on the other side, understanding that the sincerely really cool research that's being done and the technical innovation that's being done is not focused on propelling an industry forward or a company forward, But those little innovations can lead to really innovative products that actually move the needle on what our industry can do. And frankly, I mean, you know, as we're seeing now, this industry has become an important part of just defensive of, you know, culture and country and all these things that, you know, we sort of rely on.
How do you avoid going down the pathway of what VC has become? Because you're in a weird world now. Venture capital is different today than it was even 2 years ago. There's many VCs. There's so much money. There's like a specific playbook, right? Of getting a company from seed to A to B to C, and this playbook plays itself out. And as part of that playbook comes with some of these negative things that we're talking about now. You're confident that you can navigate this world with all that competition around doing all those playbook things and do it differently and still be successful?
I think I'd be very arrogant to be confident. I don't.
You understand the question.
Yeah, I absolutely understand the question. I think what gives me the most confidence is that my mentor now and sort of the person who welcomed me into this world is one of the most successful venture capitalists, in the world. He was a managing director at Sequoia Capital for many, many years, over about 20 years, and has seen this play out and has definitely been on the other side of the sort of the grinder of turning a startup into a big company, into a unicorn, you know, getting through IPOs. You know, he's sat on something like 80 boards at this point. So he's pretty much seen everything that there is to see. And he came out of that with the attitude of this needs to be done better. We need to take it back to fundamentals. We need to invest in the very, very technically sound companies that we can assist with the company building aspect of that. And the fact that, you know, someone who's been that successful, I mean, Mike does not need...
We're talking about Mike Gogan, right?
I'm talking about Mike Gogan, the founder of TubeBear. Yeah. Mike does not need, you know, to make more money. What he's focused on is the industries that can be served by deeply, deeply technical investors and driven forward by that investment.
So we're not going to see TubeBear put a bunch of people in a room and say, hey, let's create a company to copy that. You're like literally, you're doing the opposite of that.
That is so far outside of our playbook. I can't imagine that room. And honestly, if that room ended up happening, I probably wouldn't be around for very long.
This is what VC looks like today. Yep. I mean, what I just described is happening in other parts of the world and parts of place where you're basically, it's become kind of factories. Like,
certainly. You know. And we're not focused on, I think a lot of that also is driven by sort of the consumer facing, you know, we just need to get likes, we just need to get views, we just need to get GitHub stars, whatever that is. I don't think that necessarily is a fair picture of the VC industry in general. You know, I've ended up over the last year and a half interacting with a lot of other VCs as well. And you know, you have varying experiences with that. But I've actually been very pleasantly surprised by how technically deep a lot of venture is actually getting. I mean, you see now a lot of venture investment from ex-security researchers. I mean, I think you had Caleb Sima on here a while back. You know, Caleb and a group of ex-CISOs are doing a lot of venture investing now. Ron Gula from Tenable is now very, very prominent investor in the space. You know, you now have...
These are outliers, though. Like, these guys are outliers.
They're outliers, but they are bringing significant capital to bear on an industry that can be served by it.
Mm-hmm. Are you focused in a particular stage? Are you focused seed stage, A rounds? Like, what is your TubeBear's focus?
We always like to say the earlier the better. you know, I love meeting people with just an idea or just a piece of research and sort of, you know, brainstorming with them how it could become, you know, how that research could be brought to the masses and really to bear on the industry as a whole. We do focus primarily on seed stage and A. In this next fund that we're doing, we will be doing probably some Bs as well. Okay. But those Bs will be very, very carefully chosen.
So every day I'm inundated with funding news from startups and VCs. there's a lot of activity happening from A, from C to B. There's still a lot of activity happening, even with all the commotion in public markets and what we just went through. But one thing that stands out to me is like how much of it isn't real innovation. There's so much, like everyone's doing the same thing, the same kind of copycatting. You're getting a lot of pitches as well from entrepreneurs looking to get you to invest in them. Do you get the same feeling that no one is really innovating and a lot of it is just copycatting, or are you starting to see things emerging that picks your brain?
I mean, you're asking at a bit of a weird time when I hear a whole lot of pitches from companies that are basically an LLM prompt.
Oh my God. That's another world altogether. But I'm talking about just generally DSPM and data security things. It's just like everyone's just doing it. Every VC needs a version of that.
Yeah, it's frankly acronym soup. And a lot of this, you know, I put a lot of the blame on, you know, hopefully Gartner is not listening to this, but I put a lot of the blame on Gartner too. And just trying to simplify a very, very complex and nuanced topic down to segments and control sets and frankly, just, you know, meaningless acronyms. So yes, I think that you do see companies chasing those acronyms and chasing those market segments and trying to implement the AI thing because that's what everybody's worried about integrating right now. But I also think that you're seeing an unprecedented amount of innovation out of founders now. I think the state of the VC industry has gotten us to a point where it's become accessible to founders that it wouldn't have historically been accessible to start companies and real companies and really approach markets where that wasn't really possible back in the 2000s, I think.
Where are you seeing real innovation? And how much of this AI hype is real versus just let's ignore all of this stuff?
Yeah. I mean, you're talking to a bit of it, you know, I don't know if I would want to call myself an AI skeptic, but the certainly a skeptic on the current wave of AI. I think, you know, AI and machine learning and the process of data science has been around for a very, very long time. And really, in my mind, and I am not an expert in this field at all. You've interviewed people who are much, much better and able to talk about this than I am. But really, in my mind, the big innovation and kind of the killer app in AI that happened recently was the human-computer interface. So LLMs and generative AI in general, really, when you look at what those do well, it's communicate with humans, whether that communication is via, you know, generated text and responses to prompts or imagery or video or whatever that is. The commonality in generative AI is it's going into your brain, right? So it's coming out of a computer and going into your brain. And I think a lot of people, you know, if you look at applications written in, you know, on the platform of LangChain now, you know, the second that you dig into the source code, you see these paragraph long prompts that is a machine prompting itself to talk to another machine. And it's just very, very clear to me that this is not end state for computer to computer communication. So I think a lot of the innovation in AI that is going on now and is driven by this hype wave is how we define those machine-to-machine interfaces and model-to-model interfaces. I think there's tons of cool work going on there. I don't think chasing prompt-driven LLM-based engineering is the future. And I think you know we're in a bubble right now, and that's fine.
But generative AI deployments are happening at scale. Copilot is happening at scale. Microsoft is now, you know, making their billions on this stuff. So we're definitely going to see generative AI and LLM deployments in enterprise that need to be protected.
Oh, absolutely.
Inputs to those need to be protected. Sure. They have to go through governance and there's going to be compliance and there's going to be all kinds of things. Are you seeing innovation there? Real innovation there that's helping or will help that problem space?
I haven't seen I'm not going to argue that the LLM models that we're all using now aren't fundamentally innovative. They certainly are. I mean clearly the training sets that have gone into those are just on a scale that we've never seen before, which results in really great models. I think that's only possible when you're a really large company with the ability to gather a corpus of a really large training set. I think the innovation that we will see is more iterative, though. I think it's small improvements in the data science tools that are available to train, in, you know, the research going into new mechanisms for training, to use a tired cliche, it's really the picks and shovels in a gold rush more than right. It is the you know, I'm going to go out and chase the shiny thing.
What would make you not a skeptic? Like, what is an AI use case that would blow your mind?
That would blow my mind. I mean, the real test of this, I'll take a step back and mm-hmm. first, you know, talk about where I think we are now. It's really, really clear to me that the Turing test has been passed. That's the key thing that happened. And quite honestly, that happened a long time ago. You know, I remember back at NeoHapsis in the mid-2000s, putting an Eliza bot on our internal Silk channel and getting, you know, a call from one of the founders saying, somebody hacked into your computer. There's this person on Silk that I've been talking to. And obviously they're just like, you know, joking around with me and not answering my questions. And I went back in the log and it was just, you know, who are you? And then Eliza would go, who are you? So, you know, that's a pass of the Turing test in
right,
my mind.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's really clear that computers can now interface with humans and trick them. I think there's a lot of danger in that, in the sense that we think because we're tricked that the thing has sentience, the thing actually is able to make interesting decisions. The use case that would really, really blow my mind, I believe, is real time, like effective real time training of input, right? So one of the futures that I imagine, and I don't know if this will play out or not, is sort of in your browser or in your phone, having a model that actually learns as you learn. So a model that is taking in and in real time training on all of the information that you consume, all the conversations that you have, all the Zoom calls, all the podcasts that you're on, all the podcasts that you listen mm-hmm. to, and then is able to do the mundane task as you effectively. So I think the real limitation of static models is that they don't have the ability to go out and experiment with the world. You know, and LangChain moves this a little bit forward, but it's all experimentation within a single context window. Mm-hmm. It's not experimentation that feeds back into the model itself and it allows itself to train. So that training process still requires a lot of human interaction and a lot of reinforcement learning. When we get to a point where a model is actually able to have a question, go out to the world to get an answer, or play with the world and see how the world responds to it, you know, having physical action or agency, and then trains itself based on that, I think that's when we actually start to approach AGI.
The existing use cases, these co-pilots and so on, does that excite you at all? Or is this just incremental, you know, the improvement of people's lives?
Yeah, I mean, it's really exciting in the sense of, you know, development teams have gotten far, far more efficient through the use of co-pilot. I heard, I don't know how accurate this is, and I can't even remember where I heard it from, but I heard a statistic that was Visual Studio Code, which is, you know, what you're using Copilot through the majority of the time. Visual Studio Code is something like 90% AI generated at this point. So Copilot has now written 90% of the code in the,
right.
the...
Which pivots to another point I want to raise around this whole AI hype and the promise of AI is, I feel like we are creating a new generation, and this is not an original thought. I had this conversation with a company you invested in, Binarly, Alex Matrosov, mm-hmm. recently, and he made a strong point that we are creating a generation of new coders who will grow up on using ChatGPT type,
mm-hmm. Copilot
type coding, and not. We'll end up with a generation not understanding foundational computing principles. You'll be so reliant on the output of these computers that you're not learning anything. And over time, like you said, code being generated by machines, mm-hmm. by machines, over time we'll end up in this hodgepodge of a world where no one knows what's going on. And then the code is made by unreliable machines. Like, where do you see this all heading?
But I already think we're there, right? So I was, you know, back in the mid-2000s, I was one of the guys making fun of people on Full Disclosure for being into cross-site scripting and web-based attacks. And I was like, if it's not a memory safety issue, yeah, if it doesn't involve like actual memory primitives and corruption, then I'm not interested. This isn't real security work. And then, you know, fast forward a couple of years, I'm working on Chrome, and the universal XSX bug is like the bug crucial, that we care about. I've always felt that way. I felt like these higher level languages, like as you build that stack of technology and you get further and further up it, and that's your window of experience way up at the top, you don't understand the primitives going on. Like, you don't understand the hardware interface. And the question becomes, at some point, I mean, I never understood the electrical interface. Like, you know, I took digital electronics in school and everything. And I understand how gates are built and things like that.
Well, you didn't need to.
But I've never actually needed that, right? So maybe what I need to understand is that I have a certain window of experience, and these new world developers will have another window of experience. This was shifted way up from mine. But if the world works, if we get to a point where those lower levels are stable enough that they're not the issues that are actually causing the problem, then maybe that's what innovation is. Then maybe that is what advancement is.
Interesting. So in that world, we will not be worried about a generation that doesn't understand computer security principles at the bottom, or even just basic computing principles. Like, that's taken care of.
Yeah, well, I mean, the world still needs Pascal programmers and Fortran developers, right? But it needs far fewer of them than it needs, people that understand Node.js and Rust.
I'm glad you mentioned the Chrome, because you were one of the original members of the Google Chrome security team. And I blame you guys partially for overinflating the prices of vulnerabilities with the way you approached your pricing. Can we talk a little bit? Can you go back in time a little bit to the early days of the Chrome security team? And I want to ask a specific thing about the Chrome security team that stands out to me in my reporting over the years was CanSec West Pwn to Own. Do you remember you guys split out of like the official contest and did your own Pwnium vulnerability? What was that? The hacking contest?
Yeah, it was called CanSec. Pwnium. It was so. Let me tell kind of the story of how that came to be. I mean, this was the Chrome Vulnerability Rewards Program in general, and Pwnium specifically, was very much the brainchild of Chris Evans, and this was sort of during this time when the Google security team in general felt very, very empowered to go out and break things. That was largely because, you know, I think it was right around the time that the Tavis had sort of held Microsoft to account on some bug or another.
Zero was already in place, or Project
no,
Zero?
No, Project
came
Zero.
After?
Project okay. Zero was way after this. So Tavis had, you know, found this Windows bug. I think it was a kernel bug, and basically told Microsoft, hey, I want to disclose this in 90 days. They didn't fix it. He disclosed anyway. So that sort of interaction kicked off this whole thing where it actually generated a call between Sergey got a call from Steve Ballmer, and Steve basically demanded that Tavis be fired, and Sergey said no. And that simple act of that call, and somehow, you know, that call got back to all of us. But the act of that having happened gave us almost this sort of, like, you know, I compare it to being pirates a lot, but we very much felt like the empowered pirates. And there was this attitude, there was this real attitude on Chrome and at the Google security team in general, that we were doing good, and maybe, you know, right or wrong, it depends on where you fall on the history, your feelings of that. But everyone kind of went out and was like, these are the things that we need to happen in the world. And we're willing to break things to make them happen. So the Vulnerability Rewards Program specifically, and Pwnium. So Vulnerability Rewards was all about just getting researchers a safe environment to report bugs, but then also, you know, to give them something for all of their research, for all their effort. You know, and we weren't the first vulnerability rewards program. Mozilla had done it before. Microsoft had done it to some degree before.
iDefense and VeriSign and those guys all had programs going. The idea of, and it's just interesting to hear you talk a little bit about that time, because you had goodwill on your side as well. Microsoft was having all kinds of problems with IE. IE was largely unusable on the internet. There was a groundswell of industry support for something new. And the idea of Google building a browser, hiring Michael Zalewski and all these guys and putting you guys in place, put you at a time there where you could have had this rebellious attitude to just go break things and fix things, right?
Yeah, and there were a whole bunch of things that we just went out and broke. You know, Chris Palmer's effort to put HSTS in place and like actually make people use SSL and TLS did a huge amount of good for the world.
Leapfrog, yeah.
And then maybe the biggest one that's kind of like the unsung hero of it, and this is very much like Justin Chu's baby, but killing NPAPI. So killing the native plugin interface for browsers.
You replaced it with a PPAPI, right?
Well, so the first effort was actually NACL, so native client, right? The idea was
that was the Mark Dowd project.
Mark submitted a bunch of bugs to it. And that became kind of what WebAssembly is today. But really the larger effort ended up being, it ended up being almost impossible to get people to move to a new platform. So what had to happen really was like Web 2, right? Like all of the JavaScript interfaces to enable all the things that people needed Flash for. Like they needed to write this active content that had all this, you know, access directly to GPUs and access directly to sound and video and all of these things. So you know, working with like the YouTube team and making sure that a video streaming platform could work without, you know, Flash, without a native interface, you know, that was an effort that was years and years and years in the making. But I very specifically remember the day that we turned off NPAPI and we, you know, the default Chrome shipping did not have NPA turned on.
That was a big deal.
And that was a huge win. I mean, the fact that we were able to pull a platform, something that really was treated as a platform, out of the browser was massive.
You also pioneered this browser self-updater, right? The first, I believe you were the first browser that would patch itself.
Yeah, I think it was the first to, you know, you could argue that it's still not a very effective self-patching mechanism because people just sit there with.
Yeah,
if I look at my browser right now, I probably need to relaunch.
Yeah, but refresh to update.
Exactly.
But at least you pioneered the idea that automatic updates should be a real thing.
Yeah, and just that process of vulnerability management. I mean, I had back at NeoHapsis, I had worked on a lot of projects on sort of IoT devices and medical devices and things like that, and just really seen, you know, one of my very good friends ended up at a GE thinking that he could go into GE and make the medical device industry better, and just seeing how flat that effort fell. You know, I guess the browser and the consumer-facing software, so browser and obviously operating system, were the first steps in that. We still have so far to go on that, though.
What do you make of the state of browser security today? Chromium is one, obviously. We're kind of like in this weird monoculture where everything is dependent on one basic code base. But do you think we've gotten to a baseline? I don't want to call it security because that doesn't exist. But do you think we've gotten to a baseline of acceptable risk where browsers are today?
I don't know. I don't know that I would ever set the bar on what acceptable risk means, because obviously there's different there's different levels for different people. I do think that for the average consumer, the browser is no longer the way that most computers are compromised, which was not true in sort of, you know, 2010, 2011. At that time, you know, Flash bugs and Adobe Acrobat, like plug-in bugs, that's how you broke into somebody's computer. And that's how cybercrime happened. Now it's mostly phishing and things like that. And we have a long way to go on that as well. You know, if you're a nation state, you certainly still have the ability to source full-scale browser exploits.
Chrome is still patching 0 days at an alarming rate year over year. I mean, Marty Stone and those guys just put out a new report. I mean, the browser is still not...
But but this was a lot of the reason for Ponium, actually. So
Let's go back to those days as well.
When we used to go to Kansas West and go to Pwn to Own, at the end of Pwn to Own, there would be this big show. And at the end of Pwn to Own, we would get individual bugs. So it would just be like proof of concepts for the individual bugs that were exploited. And the whole theory was that gives you enough to patch this. But the point is, an actual exploit chain is a lot more than just the component bugs.
ZDI, the original organizers for Pwn to Own at that time, were not providing exploit chains to the affected vendors. You were just getting basic vulnerability reports, right?
And what we wanted to do as a browser, I mean, we had an embedded security team whose entire job was to try and harden browser security. So we didn't want to just play whack-a-mole on the bugs. We wanted to invent technologies that would make it a lot harder to exploit browsers in general.
And the researchers participating did not want to give up those exploit chains because they were reusable.
They
wanted to reuse it. So you were in
the techniques used, right?
Right. So, and I think Chokey, Bakerar, the Vupen guys were like your major nemesis at the time over these things, correct?
Yeah, I mean, this was very much another one of Justin Chu's brainchilds. But we knew this was before we had killed off NPAPI. So Flash was the way to break into Chrome. And we didn't even really have good sandboxing on the Flash process yet. So we knew that the way that Vupen was breaking Chrome, every year we'd go to Pwn to Own and they'd give us a Flash bug and go like, hey, and there's nothing we can do about it, right? So all that we could do is try and sandbox the Flash process more and cut off more abilities.
But it was cat and mouse that they were winning.
They were always going to win that war. We also knew that they loved heap sprays. So we knew enough about sort of how they operated.
Do you remember that one year when you set a trap right before Kansas West and caught them?
Justin submitted a patch just before Kansas West that very specifically blocked, a specific type of heap allocation when it hit like a certain threshold. Right. Because he was like, the only place that this ever really happens in practice is a heap spray. So we'll set an upper bound on like the number of these objects that you're allowed to allocate. And he basically like mapped the memory. He didn't like deny the allocation. He just mapped the memory like no read, no, or no write, no execute. And then when you read it, you got back, a bad idea in hex. We revved Chrome and did a Chrome release the night before Kansas Quest. So.
Yeah, I remember them tweeting about running into this bad idea. This bad idea.
Yeah, one of the researchers at Vupen woke up and did a tweet that was like, woke up to a bad idea. They still popped it, but
by then you guys had already split off and created your own Pwnium, and the motivation here was to get these exploit chains. Did that help? I mean, talk a little bit about what you got out of Pwnium and a little bit about the pricing as well, because you upped your pricing and that kind of set the stage for what vulnerability prices would eventually become.
Well, it didn't set the stage at all. What set the stage for what prices already were at the time is the price that nation states were paying for exploits.
Charlie Miller paper kind of describing that world, right?
There was a lot of research done. I can't remember who exactly did this, but there was some Google employee somewhere traveled to sort of one of these conventions and pretended to be someone from some nation state that was purchasing exploits and got pricing on exploits. So we knew exactly what the pricing was, and Pwnium, we actually came in on the low end. People were already paying, pricing back then was for full chain Chrome stuff was somewhere on the order of $250,000. And we were only paying, $100,000 or $150,000.
What do you remember about Pinkie Pie showing up at Pwn to Own and popping Chrome, getting out of the sandbox, popping all three of those browsers on that same day?
I mean, it was such a cool moment because we hadn't seen a full chain Chrome exploit. We had all these theories, and obviously we had seen things in Flash and taking advantage of plugins and all of that, but we hadn't seen.
Was that
seen
the first one you got?
That was the first one that I saw. You'd have to ask Chris Evans if he had ever seen anything before that. But we had theorized on exploit chains, and internally we had components of. But we had never seen somebody sit down and go, here is a full chain web to you know, operating system context. It was really neat.
Are we telling the audience who Pinkie Pie eventually emerged as?
I don't know. I'm not going to say his name.
those were fun times. Do you feel what do you feel is the lasting legacy of pwn-to-own, Pwnium, browser security and exploit chains and the emergence of those things? Because over the years, like, I was talking to Charlie Miller recently. He's like, I can't go to pwn-to-own today and win the contest anymore. You have to have 4 bugs and you got to get out of this sandbox. You got to touch this piece of code over here. It's become very, very complicated. Do you feel that the pwn-to-own and the concept was a big contributor to that?
I mean, I'm not smart enough to write exploits anymore. It's the people doing that work now, and frankly, a lot of the time it's teams. So it's a bunch of people getting together and you know, sharing bugs and sharing techniques. But I've heard feedback from groups that actually develop, you know, frankly, weapons for military use, where now it's specialist based, right? So now each person on the team has a specialty. You know, they find the bug or source the bug for the specific little part, and then write that part of the exploit chain. And that's very much what, you know, that's what I saw when we took Pegasus apart and things like that. It's a modular system built up, which frankly, there's a lot of benefit to outing tools and techniques for those groups because of the complexity that it takes. I mean, you have to, it's a software engineering effort. It's the same as any software engineering team. It's just, they're focused on exploitation instead of building a product.
Why are they always winning? Why are the advanced adversary always winning this race?
I mean, I often question why I ever made the decision to go to the defensive side at all. You know, I spent the beginning of my career and then another part after Google on the offensive side. And man, I love the offensive side because it's the winning side of an arms race, right? I mean, by definition, offense will always win because defense has to work in the open and offense can work in the shadows. And you know, as long as you're doing your job right, no one will ever know what your techniques are and how you're operating. And then the second that it's detected, you just iterate. Yeah. I remember the days back when getting your C2 to bypass like AV products. Now it's EDR or XDR or whatever people are calling it now. But getting your payloads to bypass those things was literally just a process of changing one character in the code because you just need a different hash. And then for a long time, you know, it's gotten harder now. You know, and Microsoft is frankly to thank for that. Mm-hmm. I think with Windows Defender. But it's still very, very possible to bypass. As long as you know what you need to bypass, there will always be a way to bypass it.
One of the things that was not very well known was that Chrome had an antivirus scanner built into it. I believe you guys were partnering with ESET or one of these companies. At the same time when Tavis and Project Zero was slamming AV and like AV was just introducing way more risk than anything else. And at the same time, Chrome had an AV scanner running in there silently in the background doing all these things.
Yeah. Calling it built into Chrome is a little bit of a misnomer.
I didn't put it in. I mean, if I'm a Chrome user, it runs in my browser. It's still there.
I'm not sure if we're talking about the same thing because there may have been an actual like Chrome embedded AV product much later.
This is a third party AV scanner that was built into Chrome and was doing some basic things
after my time. What was there during my time was the VirusTotal integration. So for example, when you download something, it's checking it against the VirusTotal database to make sure that there's nothing malicious or it's not like a known malicious piece of code.
Yeah. The thing is how did Google kind of, I'm going down a rabbit hole that I really shouldn't be going down.
I think it's a fair question in the sense of, you know, and you'd have to, I would love for you to have Tavis on and ask him.
Well, you can't tell me there isn't someone or some people at Chrome looking for those special things that scanner and that VirusTotal integration might flag. I mean, there's a reason Google security team is able to catch.
some of the biggest things. All sorts of tricks are used to try and catch bad actors. I mean, look at you know, turning on certificate pinning for for Google.com, right? You know, when Chris Palmer did that and flipped that bit, on the first day, I believe it was, we saw two valid Chrome or Google.com certificates issued by CAs that weren't Google. You know, that was just a technique that we were able to use because of our position as a browser to identify bad actors in the CA space. And I mean, DigiNotar went out of business.
Right.
Another CA that I'm not sure if it's public got scolded privately about their behavior.
Another thing that's not quite known, and maybe you can help me understand, is when I use Chrome on my iPhone, I'm not really using Chromium, right? It's a shell around WebKit.
You're using the Apple, whatever Apple provides as the web view, because it's sort of impossible to write a browser on the iPhone platform without being Apple.
But do I get all this, the Google Chrome security browser mitigations and so on in there? Chrome on this is the equivalent of using Safari, basically.
Yeah, you're getting the exact web view that Apple releases just broadly on iPhone.
All right, let me switch gears a little bit.
Unless, and again, my knowledge of this is almost a decade old.
Fair enough.
People are watching.
I want to take you back also a decade old. You also spent time at Lookout Security doing some of the earliest work into Pegasus and some of these what we call private sector PSOAs. What's the new term for it? These spyware, spyware vendors.
Honestly, I'm so far from being a threat hunter that I don't know any of the acronyms in that world, but I have had the opportunity to tear apart some cool exploits in my day. I'll tell you a bit of the Citizen Lab story and Lookout and how the original Pegasus thing happened. I was actually on a plane to Vegas with Mike Murray when Citizen Labs gave that to Lookout. Journalist had sort of like seen some fishy behavior. He knew a researcher in Toronto over at Citizen Labs. They knew Mike because Mike, you know, had sort of grown up in Toronto. So they reached out to Mike and they were like, Lookout probably has the technical ability to take this apart. So he had pulled in like Max Bisley and a bunch of the technical Lookout team, which is actually a bunch of some of the old Blue Box guys were really most of that team.
Like those guys, yeah.
And so I was sitting there. I was sitting there with Mike, and you know, he knew that I had worked on a bunch on WebKit and sort of that layer of it. And then we had some. I was doing Divergent Security at the time with Dave Glady, and we had a bunch of subcontractors that were you know. Really good, like iOS, like kernel guys and things like that. So he kind of knew about that. So he was like, "Hey, do you guys want to tear this apart? You guys are probably in a better position to actually do it than our team is." So we came in and kind of did with Max. Max and I were kind of led the team that tore apart the original Pegasus, and it was a cool process. I got roped into it after they had already. Just the process of capturing that payload in a way where we weren't tipping off NSO was tricky. And I came in a little bit after that. By the time that I came in, we actually had the payloads. But man, it was, you question yourself at every turn there. If you go back and read that report, there's a whole section on this null deref that I wrote that I'm pretty sure was a bailout mechanism to try and keep it from being reported into like crash monitoring systems and stuff like that. But I always like even when we were releasing the report, I was just like, I hope that's what this is. And it's not, you know, somebody's not going to come school me that like, well, no, actually this is doing this other thing. And if you actually knew what you were doing in iOS exploitation, you would have known that.
Does it surprise you that it's 2024 and those guys are still winning?
I mean, not really. There will always be state-sponsored, just madness. I mean, humans are just fundamentally like, we're violent and we like to take advantage where we can, and we're, you know, we're human, frankly, and part of that will always be war and strife and all of that. And I'm, you know, I've always very specifically tried myself to stay away from nation state stuff, at least on the offensive side, just because I don't want something that I write to be responsible for somebody dying, you know. And it's true. That's what a lot of this stuff is used for. It's, you know, maybe not directly. It's not like making a Hellfire missile quite, but you are making a piece of software that tells somebody who wants to use a Hellfire missile where to send that missile to kill somebody. So,
and as long as Apple keeps adding features and iMessage and all these things to it, there are always going to be new attack surfaces, and these guys are always going to be, I mean, they're motivated enough and resourced enough to be able to break in. Is lockdown mode the best we can hope for?
I don't know. I mean, ask Michael Zalewski. He's living in the woods in Montana now. Actually, I found out after I moved to Montana that he was a couple miles away from me. I had no idea where he was. But no, I mean, I think the best that we have is move to the woods and don't use a computer.
I can't let you go. You mentioned Mike Murray. What was your prevailing memory of Mike Murray?
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, Mike was one of my best friends in the world.
He was a force of nature. I never got to work with him, but he was just like, he would come into a room and he would just like, you know, one of those guys.
Yeah. I think in human experience, if you get technically deep enough and interested enough in any given topic, you know, you'll run into a lot of people, and some of those people are kind of defending space for themselves, and some of those people are too busy with their own stuff to really pay attention. And then there's this really, really small group of people that you'll meet as you actually have technically interesting conversations about a really obscure topic, that just, you have no right to be talking to them. They gain nothing by talking to you because they're the ones teaching you. But for whatever reason, they take you under their wing and just guide you into that world and open those doors. And, you know, I can look at my life and I have a bunch of those people. Like, you know, the first one was Neil Archibald was trolling some IRC channel that I was in and invited me in to pull the plug, like this invite only group of like real hackers. And then Greg Shipley gave me a chance at NeoHapsis, and Justin Chu gave me a chance on Google Chrome. And you know, most recently, Mike Gogan gave me a chance in venture capital. And Mike was
one of those guys.
Yeah. Mike, through my whole life, I mean, I met him at NeoHapsis, and just through my whole life, he was one of those forces of nature, which just the level of access that he had into just so many, like, he taught me how to be social. He taught me how to, you know, social engineer and navigate the business world. And he taught me, you know, so much about computer security and all those things. And he was just, you know, Mike really, and maybe my prevailing sort of feeling about him and his legacy is the social debt that I owe to the world, you know, for the benefits that I've, like, the where I am because of those type of people, is to do that for other people and to try and give that back to others.
You find yourself channeling him now as you're dealing with your entrepreneurs, the people you're investing in. And let's pivot quickly, because we're running out of time. What are some in your last two or three investments that you've made that excites you, and why take a stab in this particular area?
Yeah, I mean, my last investment, which you already mentioned, was Binarly, and I met Alex for whatever reason we hadn't met before, but I met him last year, and we just, you know, we started geeking out on you know, automated reverse engineering. And obviously I had been at Google back when Halvar's, you know, company had been bought, and seen, like, you know, the progression of like Bendiff and Ben Navi, and watched, you know, IDA progressing into, you know, like X-rays and all this cool research. And, you know, and really, really just started geeking out with Alex on a lot of that, and what sort of automated reverse engineering and binary analysis can be, and what that can mean for the future of, you know, not just automated vulnerability detection, but also, you know, as we saw recently with like the XZ stuff, you know, their mechanism for doing this is functionally also a way to detect malicious code patterns as well. So I'm just really, really excited about taking something that's that deeply technical. That's, you know, it's reverse engineering. Like those companies don't raise huge rounds.
Right.
And turning that into what it can be. So
where do you see the commercial opportunities?
I mean, all over the place. I mean, right now in the very, very near term, there's all of this emphasis right now on sort of like ATO, like authorization to operate in, you know, government use cases and things like that. So all of a sudden there's this big market opportunity for things, simple things like the generation of accurate SBOM and doing like accurate SCA and, you know, generating VEX information and all of that. So there's an immediate market for this, which is actually going to become a very large market. But in the much longer term, I actually think that there's plays in supply chain in general. So having gating mechanisms and creating standards bodies around when a Docker container, not even is uploaded to Docker Hub, although that's a pretty interesting moment in the security lifecycle of a container and sort of supply chain management. But when that Docker container is orchestrated into Kubernetes, say, or orchestrated into some cloud environment, and the code is actually about to be run, the ability to validate through the bits all the way down to the individual code artifacts so that you actually know and can validate what code is executing in your environment and what checks have been performed against that code and who's attesting to the fact that those... And that attestation is not just some CISO signing a piece of paper and saying like, yeah, I have, you know, SolarWinds, right? Yes, I have these controls in place. And yes, I did this stuff, but you can actually validate it all the way back down.
Right. With false positives as low as possible.
Yep. Yeah. And that's the big challenge in that space right now. And that's the reason vulnerability management is so hard right now is the, you know, every CISO that I talk to is just dealing with this, you know, tidal wave of false positives. So there's all of these things, all these problems that we have to solve. I mean, one really obvious one is just reachability analysis, right? Like, mm-hmm. I think the holy grail is when we get to a place where the log4j response is not, I have no idea where log4j even is in my infrastructure because I've got all these IoT devices and you know, and machines all over the place that could have some Java thing that could have that jar file. So number one, solving that. But number two, and this is really the sort of, you know, city on the hill that we're trying to get to, knowing which network interfaces are connected into, you know, Java strings that will end up in the function call to the vulnerable log4j function, and being able to trace that all the way back to the network level and go, this is where I need to microsegment. So mm-hmm. I know where this vulnerability is. I can microsegment in the moment that I know that this vulnerability exists to make sure that interface is not accessible from the network. And then number two, I have the patch already available to fix that and make sure that thing, you know, that string can't make it off right. out of a packet across the network into log4j.
That inspectability and verifiability yep. with one click of a button becomes yeah. kind of the holy grail.
And man, do we have a long way to go for that. But I think we're moving in the right direction and we can get there iteratively.
We are both AI skeptics, but do you see some AI magic dust helping here?
I think a sprinkling of, you know, what's gotten really easy with LLMs now is extracting fairly accurate context from unstructured data, right? Which honestly, you know, when you look at what is the process of, as a pen tester, like what were the tricks that I used to use when there was a SOC in play and when you were trying to do like a super under the radar assessment, and you know, you're creating a bunch of noise and you're, you know, you're saying, look at the puppet over here when I'm really over here and all of those things. And really what you're exploiting in that case is limited resources, right? So you're right. exploiting the fact that the security operations center doesn't have, you know, doesn't have enough people, enough time, enough eyeballs to analyze something. So that's one place where I can see, you know, using AI to minimize it down to, oh yeah, we think that these are actually the relevant events. But there's also, you know, weaknesses in that. Like once the attackers know this model is used and this prompt is used into that model, they'll just find a way to bypass that one right. prompt.
I can question you for an hour, not an hour, on a bunch of different things. We haven't even spoken about the government's involvement in security these days, supply chain issues. So this means you have to come back.
All right, you got it. Anytime.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Chris Necker, partner at Two Bear Capital. Appreciate the time.
Thank you so much, Ryan.